The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
How do we keep going when life seems unsure? And then, are smartphones actually harmful to youth mental health? You're listening to The Common Good. Happy Thursday, friends. Welcome to The Common Good here on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. So glad to have you with us today on this Thursday afternoon. If you've missed any of our show this week, go get the podcast wherever it is you get your podcast. Just subscribe, rate, review. You can also find us online at 1160hope.com, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Common Good Talk. It continues to be cold and blustery out there today, but it's coming. Did you see next week? It looks like it's going to be in the 60s, and it's coming. So spring is around the corner. Just hold on for the next day or two. Speaking of holding on, how do we keep going when life seems to be uncertain? That's what I want to start today by thinking about. When life is uncertain, how do we keep going? So let me give you some examples. For me, as I've told you, we are merging churches with another church. And this Sunday is our first Sunday as the new church. We were Four Corners Community Church. We're merging with a church called Downers Grove Community Church. And we became a new church called the Grove Church. And it's going to be awesome. We're excited. But both former congregations are having to navigate. Everything's different now. What's it going to be like? It has this important thing like my church now fundamentally changed. And there's lots of feelings of change. There's lots of feelings of, and with feelings of change can come uncertainty. But uncertainty is one of the only certain things in life, isn't it? Your kids age and continue to get older, and there's this uncertainty, right? I feel like I just figured out how to parent a toddler, and now they're 10 years old. I feel like I just figured out how to parent a 10-year-old, and now they're a teenager. And I feel like I just figured out how to parent a teenager, and now they're going off to college. And the only certainty is uncertainty. The only constant is change. Maybe you're in a job and you feel like it's going well and you love your job, and then the job goes away. Or maybe you feel like things are good in your life, and then a health issue comes. With the uncertainty of life, with life changing, what do you do? How do you navigate that? What is the answer? Because there's a lot of answers that aren't any good. Don't worry, it'll be okay. Or your life won't have these curveballs in them. Sure, they will. All of our lives do. It's just life. It's, again, the only certainty is uncertainty. The only constant is change. Just when you think things are all normal, like you have things figured out, things will change, whether it's with, like I said, parenting or marriage or relationships, job. For my sake right now, it's church. And I think for us, especially as Christ followers, the answer on some level foundationally has to be Hebrews 13:8. That in the midst of all of the change, in the midst of uncertainty and all the feelings those bring forth, Hebrews 13:8 tells us Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. That as we look for consistency and something constant in life, as we look for a firm foundation upon which to rest our lives, It cannot be in our circumstances because circumstances change, but it can be in our Savior because he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Jesus gives that teaching where he says those who build their lives essentially on the things of this world, those are like shifting sands. We've all been at the beach. You build that sand castle, the waters, the storm, whatever comes, and it collapses because it's not built on anything steady. But Jesus says, build your house upon the rock. Build your house upon the rock, and then it will stand. You think about that as we were watching those crazy images out of Taiwan this week of that earthquake. It was a heavy earthquake, and there's so much video. Did you see the one of the guy in the pool as the water's sloshing around, or people driving and the road is moving? And they were just harrowing. They were just some crazy, crazy images. And the destruction was bad, but as you watch the news, it could have been so much worse. And the reason it wasn't worse is because Taiwan has a lot of earthquakes, and so they have a good emergency system, but also they have really high bar for new construction and codes to withstand earthquakes. And so when this big earthquake comes, things don't just collapse. They're built on solid foundation. And friends, that's the picture for us as Christians. What are we building our life on? Like, your life might be doing great right now, but don't fool yourself to believe that it will necessarily always be great, that your circumstances will always be wonderful. And when that storm comes, when that earthquake hits, when things in life start shaking, what are you going to do? How do you stand up under that? What is the answer? Jesus says that build your house upon the rock, which will stand, a firm foundation, which is him. He's describing himself. And so if you're going through craziness right now, if your circumstances are terrible or bad, look to Jesus. He is a firm foundation. And you know what? He's constant. He's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And also, if you're living in relative comfort right now, relative ease, things are going swimmingly, the waters are calm, if you will. Awesome. Rejoice in that. But also know that the storms come. In this world, Jesus said, you will have trouble. And we don't know when that is coming. We don't know. Things change in the blink of an eye. And we have to be prepared for that. And when our circumstances change, and again, as we said, the only constant in this life is change. The only certainty is uncertainty. The one thing or the one person that is constant, that is certain, is Jesus Christ. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. That gives us confidence. That gives us hope. That gives us a firm foundation no matter what is going on in our lives. I saw this fascinating discussion going on over Twitter. I've told you before, I grew up in the evangelical world, and now I'm raising my children right in the evangelical world. I was, you know, we grew up in a little church that had a great impact on me growing up. Where I grew up in New Jersey, had a great youth group, would never miss it. I went on all the trips. My youth pastor played a huge role in my life. We were that family that was always at church and always the last ones to leave. Same was the true with my wife. And now there's a lot of people who grew up that way, right? Listening to Christian music, wearing the Christian t-shirts, doing the Christian thing all the time. And there's this pushback against it. And somebody wrote something on Twitter that I think I feel like I understand and I resonate with, even though I hadn't put words to it. This is just somebody named Ann Carlson Kennedy. I have no idea who she is, but she wrote this. The thing that drives me most crazy about every ex-evangelical book, those are the people who were evangelical and are no longer, right? The thing that drives me most crazy about most or about every ex-evangelical book I've had to read is how disrespectful of parents the writer generally is and how incurious about theology and the past. No functional culture would countenance this sort of incurious disrespect. Andrew Walker, professor and editor, and wrote, kind of quote tweeted it and wrote this. A friend once observed to me, would love to read a memoir that goes something like this. I grew up evangelical, was made to listen to Adventures in Odyssey, forced to go to Wheaton, was taught abstinence, saw my parents put up a Bush Cheney sign, and I'm fine. That made me laugh when I read it. Let me read it again in case you missed any of this stuff. Would love to read a memoir that goes something like this. I grew up evangelical, was made to listen to Adventures in Odyssey, forced to go to Wheaton, was taught abstinence, saw my parents put up a Bush Cheney sign, and I'm fine. And then you start going through some of the replies, and they are really fantastic of people just saying, yeah, I get that. Like, it wasn't perfect, but there was good things. And so it started this Twitter thread, right? Gabriel Hughes, he's a pastor. He wrote this. I grew up in a Christian home, taken to church every Sunday, was made to listen to Adventures in Odyssey. A lot of Adventures in Odyssey out there. I did not listen to that. And only Christian music, couldn't play violent video games, was taught abstinence, saved myself until marriage. My parents always voted Republican, and I'm fine. Somebody else wrote, for every ex-evangelical, there are thousands of us who met Jesus in an evangelical church and cherish our upbringing. And the replies go on and on. Somebody else wrote, this doesn't make for a good book. And I'm getting caught reading through these. This doesn't mean that there weren't problems, right, in the evangelical kind of culture. This doesn't mean that there weren't problems in that subculture that many of us were raised in. But there's been this move in ex-evangelical deconstruction these days that it's become this cottage industry to throw stones not only at the culture that many of us were raised in, but almost taking strays in that is our parents who raised us in those cultures. And I do resonate with the one that said it's disrespectful. But also, it's dangerous. Because I don't want to downplay that there aren't a lot of people out there questioning things from their childhood, questioning things from their evangelical upbringing, this evangelical subculture. But I know for my own life, by and large, while not perfect, it laid a foundation upon which my adulthood has been built, now being a pastor and now raising my kids in the church and in that evangelical subculture. Was it a little too legalistic? Was it a little too good Christians don't do this and don't do this and don't do this and do this and do this? Yeah, probably. Most of us were raised in youth ministries that function that way and churches that function that way. But I guess the point is it could be worse. It could be worse. And now there's this rejection of evangelicalism with many people who were raised that way. Because if I'm blunt, now some people have very legitimate reasons for that and very legitimate doubts and questions. And there was abuse in the background. I get it. I'm not speaking for everybody here, but for a lot of people that I read who are quote unquote ex-evangelical or deconstructing, you know, I worry, like Matt Chandler said a year or two ago, that it's the trendy thing to do. And because it could be the trendy thing to do, this is the books that get written. These are the blogs that get amplified. These are the tweets that get shared. And we start to live in this world where we believe everybody who was raised in evangelicalism is rejecting it. It's just not true. Like, I thank God for my church growing up, my youth ministry growing up, my time at Wheaton College. I was so formed in a good way by it that I've kind of entered into it in adulthood, pastoring, radio show, sending a daughter to Hope College right now. And I just think we need to be careful thinking that we know better all the time, that I'm going to reject what was done by my parents because that's what we're supposed to do, reject what was done by our parents. The same way they probably thought they should reject what their parents did. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Were there things from 1980s and 1990s evangelical subculture that weren't healthy or positive that are worth rethinking? Obviously, yes. Does that mean we ditch it all and throw away our faith and deconstruct and exvangel? No. No. Let's continue to think. Let's continue to reform. Let's continue. But let's continue to believe. And let's look for the things from our past that we can be thankful for. A youth pastor who cared and taught the Bible. You know, a church that lived on mission and looked to reach the community. A college, in my case, that proclaimed that it was for Christ and his kingdom. Let's not throw everything out and call everything bad because it sells books. And it makes you become well known. I really resonated with this when this person wrote this, because I think there is a lot of truth to it. We are essentially starting a new church as we have merged churches with another church in town to start a new church. And this Sunday is our first service together. We did Good Friday together, but this is the first actual service together. And so, I look forward to I'll share everything about it on Monday. You could be praying for our church. They were Downers Grove Community Church. We're Four Corners Community Church. We are now together in Downers Grove to launch the Grove Church, and done a ton of work to get prepared for this. And now here we go. Let the journey begin. In some ways, it feels like when you get married and you're engaged and you do all this work, premarital counseling, planning for a wedding, all of the plans for the honeymoon, and everything's about the wedding. And then you get married and you're reminded, oh, now we live together. Now this is just the beginning. That's what I always tell engaged couples when we do premarital counseling or when I give the homily at a wedding. It's, hey, we treat the wedding as if it's the end. It's really just the start. And that's kind of how I feel about this church merger, right? Like, we've been building for over a year to like this week, that it can feel like, okay, now we've got to the end. We made it. And in reality, it's just the start. It's just the start. And so I look forward to sharing stories about it, and glad to do it. One of the things we talk a lot on this show, especially with kids, is the kind of debate about smartphones and media. And in fact, there's a new book that's kind of amplified the fierce debate, it says, around teens, mental health, and smartphones. The author is Jonathan Haidt, and his new book is called The Anxious Generation. It was published last week, and it argues that the smartphone-driven great rewiring of childhood, that's the quote, great rewiring of childhood, is causing a, quote, epidemic of mental illness. He suggests four ways to combat this. They are no smartphones before high school, no social media before 16, no phones in schools, and prioritizing real world play and independence. In an interview with today.com, the author said, I call smartphones experience blockers because once you give the phone to a child, it's going to take up every moment. And that is not nailed down. That is not nailed down to something. It's basically the loss of childhood in the real world. Now, phones and social media have become a ubiquitous part of everyday life. But as much as researchers study their impact, there remains no easy answer to how exactly these technologies affect the mental health of kids and teens. So his book quickly has generated a wave of both support and backlash. That's what a good book does. Support and backlash, including a viral review in the scientific journal Nature that argues that hate is contributing to a, quote, rising hysteria around social media and screen time that's unproductive in addressing the, quote, real causes of teen depression and anxiety. In this scathing review, Candace Odgers, a psychologist, wrote, we have a generation in crisis and in desperate need of the best of what science and evidence-based solutions can offer. Unfortunately, our time is being spent telling stories that are unsupported by research and that do little to support young people who need and deserve more. As you know, over the past decade, scholars and politicians have grown increasingly concerned about the potential impact of social media and screen time on young kids. There have been Senate hearings, grilling CEOs of social media companies. In January, California introduced a bill trying to protect kids from social media addiction. And last week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law a ban on children under 14 even joining social media. So what's the research say? Well, research linking social media to use to poor youth mental health led the Surgeon General to issue an advisory last year warning of social media's potential harms to child and adolescent well-being. Up to 95% of youth ages 13 to 17 say they use social media, with more than one-third saying they use it almost constantly. But the toothpaste can't be squeezed back into the tube, can it? The kids who are on smartphones and social media now will be using those technologies well into old age. And it'll be their turn to freak out once a new and unfamiliar technology threatens to displace their habits. So really the question is, what do we do? What are the answers? We can debate it back and forth about the positive versus the negative. I love how the associate research scientist at Columbia School of Journalism said 90% of this debate is basically just back and forth about different studies that are subtly designed differently and create totally different results. Rather than asking, is it negative or is it positive? It'd be much easier, it'd be much more productive if we could ask, what are the impacts and to whom and which thing does it and how can we change it? So that's the question. How do you wrestle with smartphones in your own life, in the life of your kids, your grandkids? What do you believe is the answer? Because there's a lot that we can, there's a lot of studies that go back and forth. I would suggest this, that smartphones are good for teenagers and above. It's how they connect with each other through texting, right? It's how we can stay connected to our kids. Even while my daughter is overseas right now, we're able to stay connected regularly. But then I think that it can go too far, much like video games, much like television. It can go too far where kids get addicted. And we do know with an increase in social media use, things like Instagram and TikTok and Snapchat and whatever else our kids are on these days, that it has an adverse effect upon especially girls' self-image, how they view themselves. Everybody posts their best things. And so when we see other people's best things, then we start to see them as everyone else is better than us. Their life is better. They look better, whatever else it might be. We know these things. Friends, I want to remind you of what the answer is. The answer is that we as adults need to model what good use of smartphones, technology, social media looks like. We need to be willing to put our phones down. We need to be willing to turn off the television. We need to be willing to get off our computers. On some level, our children, especially at a young age, are just mimicking what they're seeing in their parents. So if you don't want your kid addicted to their smartphone, get off your smartphone. If you don't want to see your kid addicted to Instagram, get off Facebook. Be creative with it. Hey, family, we're going to do something for the next week. No smartphones during this time or whatever. There's a million things you can do. Do the research. I would say that what the technology affords our children right now is both positive and also really negative. It's affecting their mental health. We see things like anxiety and depression and even teen suicide continue to be on the rise. They're at the highest levels they've ever been. And we'd be putting our head in the sand to say that our technology and the connectedness is not at least partially to blame for that. So be wise. You're the parent. Be wise. Stop that tide, but also mirror it in your own life. This one's not going away. This is only going to get more and more. But I want to talk pastoring. But I also, this article about pastoring, this is at a website called For the Church, written by Tyler Green. This is about pastoring. But I also think this is about life. And we're going to try to make that connection here. So even if you're not a pastor, stay with me here, because I think the purpose here, the point of this article, ends up being a life lesson article. This is For the Church. Pastoring is tortoise work, a lesson for the young and aspiring. He writes, talking with a fellow pastor I know and trust, I recently asked a question. What's one quality you believe is indispensable for an effective pastor? After a moment's thought, the answer came, patience. If you aspire to pastoral ministry, you likely envision yourself preaching the word, administering the sacraments. Perhaps you also envision counseling sessions, praying with those who are hurt, leading ministries of the church. All good things. But have you taken time to consider the kind of patience these things actually require? Have you envisioned yourself learning the hard lesson of being patient and moving slowly? If you'd rather not, then one of two things will eventually happen after you enter ministry. You'll be crushed or you will change. He continues, when I was in my 20s and aspiring to the pastorate, I gave little to no consideration to the need for patience. And on certain days, I find that I still can be this way. Pastors struggle with impatience concerning life's circumstantial ambiguities, those unresolved things we are chagrined to live with. Ministry is so filled with such ambiguities that a pastor must learn what to do with them. As much as I may not like it, pastoring is slow, steady work. It is tortoise work, not hair work, right? Tortoise and the hare. So he's going to go on and talk about this. But let's make an observation here. A lot of good things in life are just about showing up and just about patience. Some of the pastors that I respect the most, it used to be the ones with just great charisma and big churches, seem to be doing all sorts of crazy stuff. What it is now is when I look around and I'm like, man, that pastor right there has been going at it for 20 years, 30 years. That person is worth being listened to and taking it, going out to coffee with them and picking their brain. There's a Eugene Peterson, long obedience in the same direction feeling, specifically in the pastor role. We love to point to things that are new, right? Well, that
most people plant in churches are in their 20s, right? And they've got all the new ideas that I'm going to change the world. And but then you got that pastor up the street who's been faithfully ministering for 20 years, 30 years. They've got the experience. They've got the skins. They've got the history. But isn't this how life is? Again, when we're in our 20s, we think everything's now, 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 now. But so much of life is just about doing the right things today, doing the right things tomorrow, and the next day, and the next day. Again, I already mentioned him, but it's Eugene Peterson's famous book, and quote, "A long obedience in the same direction." We think everything's a sprint, but it's this long obedience with Jesus in sight. I'm walking towards him. I'm moving towards him. It's a long obedience in the same direction. There's power in that. I have two dogs, and the younger one of the dogs, Jersey, is 3 or 4 now. She is a mini golden doodle. That would make you think she's actually golden. She's not. She's white and black. Awesome dog. Awesome dog. Jersey loves to go for walks. But when we go for walks with Jersey, it is it could be a stressful experience. Because not only does she love to bark at things, and she gets so distracted that she never walks in a straight line. It's like this. It's almost like water skiing, side to side to side, sniffing, barking, running, walking, everything back and forth. And I've always thought that that's a picture of how many of us live our lives. Squirrel, 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 back and forth, back and forth. Never with that long obedience in the same direction. Obedience today, obedience tomorrow, obedience the next day, stacking day upon day upon day. Like, who are the people that you respect the most? As I get older, it's increasingly people who have had a steadfastness, a faithfulness, a consistency, not a charisma, not a big splash. Those come and go. But it's the people who just keep going. Let me read how they end this article. Let's be honest, he writes. Much too often, quote, "making things happen is a fruit of pride. The proud in spirit feel they must force a quick fix when faced with prolonged circumstantial ambiguity. They are compulsive and cannot trust God with what they do not understand about his timing. Too self-interested to wait, they attempt to supplant his unhurried work. However, God honors those who wait patiently upon him. Humility accompanies the learning of this lesson. Ultimately, a pastor does not control his ministry circumstances, and our best efforts to eliminate their ambiguity may well make things worse." Going ahead, he writes, "Mark these things well, all who aspire to such a noble task. God's ways are not our ways. In his always wise estimation, the best things come with time. Therefore, alongside your study of scripture and theology, preaching and ministry methods, befriend patience also. Though often underestimated, it will be your pastoral superpower. Here's a good life lesson. Slow and steady wins the race." Friends, I think this is true just for life in general. Slow and steady wins the race. Think about marriage. There's that honeymoon period where everything is new and everything is wonderful and everything is, it's just the honeymoon period. But then you've been married 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And there's a depth to that marriage that comes with time, faithfulness, steadfastness, and just doing life together. Patience as a virtue. Patience as the key to a God-honoring life. I think this is true for pastors, and I think it's true just for life. Well, there's a fascinating article over at the Atlantic, of all places. It's fascinating because it's at the Atlantic. What I'm about to read would not be fascinating if we read it at Christianity Today or the Gospel Coalition. But the fact that it's at the Atlantic, I think, is noteworthy. The title of the article is The True Cost of the Church Going Bust. Now, the author, listen to the very first three words, as an agnostic. So this is a non-believer. This is somebody who says, you know, an atheist says there is no God. An agnostic says, I don't know. I got no idea. I don't follow a religion. That's kind of what an agnostic is. The author says, as an agnostic, I've spent most of my life thinking about the decline of faith in America in mostly positive terms. Organized religion seemed to me beset by scandal and entangled in noxious politics. So I thought, what is there really to mourn? Only in the past few years have I come around to a different view. Maybe religion, for all of its faults, works a bit like a retaining wall to hold back the destabilizing pressure of American hyper-individualism, which threatens to swell and spill over in its absence. And then it's going to then unpack what's been going on. And it's research we've talked about here on the show many times. It's unpacking the decline in church attendance across religious faiths. So the Christians and the evangelicals, but also in Muslims and others. And so for an agnostic, there's really no difference. So they look at these collectively. And especially since COVID, but really, if you go back to the 1960s, everybody was going to church. Then the 1980s, most people still identified as church going into the, and it's just been on this decline, and that decline has accelerated. Now, within the last couple of years, we've gotten to the point where more people say, I don't go to church than say that they do. More people say that I don't have a religion than say that they do. We've kind of had that tipping point here as a culture. And this person says is an agnostic. You would think they would be celebrating that, but they said, much like when we listened to that clip the other day of Richard Dawkins, where Richard Dawkins said, I'm a cultural Christian, and tried to acknowledge the role that Christianity has played within the culture of in his case, Great Britain, that it's a positive thing. And here this agnostic person, this author says, might organized religion, might Christianity in particular, have been a retaining wall to the hyper-individualism of our culture? The author goes on to say, the relationship with organized religion provided many things at once. Not only a connection to the divine, but also a historical narrative of identity, a set of rituals to organize the week and year, and a community of families. The survey found that the most important feature of religion for the dwindling number of Americans who still attend services a few times a year included experiencing religion in community and instilling values in their children. So this agnostic goes on to say, when I read the survey, this emphasis on community is what caught my eye. As I recently reported, the United States is in the midst of a historically unprecedented decline in face-to-face socializing. The social collapse is steepest for some of the groups with the largest declines in religiosity. For example, young people who are fleeing religion faster than older Americans have also seen the largest decline in socializing. Boys and girls ages 15 to 19 have reduced their hangouts by more than 3 hours a week, according to one survey. There is no statistical record of any period in U.S. history where young people were less likely to attend religious services, and also no period when young people have spent more time on their own. And then they go to a similar story with working class Americans, low income. And this is having the decline in religion has cut people off from a crucial gateway, he writes, to civic engagement and to just community in general. This is an opportunity for the church. This is an opportunity. This is also the story we read earlier in the week about churches that are popping up who are atheist churches. And they're driven by community. They're driven by community. The article ends this way. Religious ritual often requires that we make contact with the sacred in the presence of other people, whether in a church, a mosque, a synagogue, or over a dinner table prayer. In other words, the religious ritual is typically embodied, synchronous, deep, and collective. The author says, I'm not advocating that every atheist and agnostic in America immediately choose a world religion and commit themselves to weekly church attendance. But I wonder if, in foregoing organized religion, an isolated country has discarded an old and proven source of ritual at a time when we most need it. Making friends as an adult can be hard. It's especially hard without a scheduled weekly reunion of congregants. Finding meaning in the world is hard, too. It's especially difficult if the oldest symptoms of meaning-making hold less and less appeal. It took decades for Americans to lose religion. It might take decades to understand the entirety of what we lost. That's Derek Thompson at The Atlantic, an agnostic, saying we've lost something community, as a culture, as a country. And that's community. Friends, those of us who are committed to church, those of us who do go to church, those of us who are parts of Christian communities, this is an opportunity. We live in a culture of loneliness, where even an agnostic will write an article that says, maybe the church is onto something. Maybe the church knows something. And it's our opportunity to say, not only do we have community built around meaning, and let me share that meaning. The first thing in this is dive into Christian community. Lean in. If you're a Christ follower, you need others. Lean into that community. And then let us go invite others into that community. If you ever follow those sites of like what happened in the world on this day in history, those can be fascinating, remind you of the major moments of history. Today is the anniversary, I believe, 1968? So that is 32 plus 24, 56 years ago was the death, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And that reminds us, I wasn't alive at that time, but the importance of his life and what he did and the tragedy of his death. I saw this as a retweet from his daughter. Just kind of talking about her experience. And that's a major day in the history of our nation. As you know, I'm a pastor, and so I am raising pastors' kids. And that's always had this stigma to it. I think one of the reasons the stigma of the pastor's kid exists is because pastors did a bad job parenting their kids back in a few generations ago, because there was this common understanding. You would hear it said, I'm going to focus on the church and God will help with my kids, or my wife will raise the kids. I will. And that's just terrible theology. The church will not last. That specific church, you're going to at some point not work at that church. That's your job. And yes, you give your life to it. You give your attention to it, but it's your job. Whereas your kids are your family and your life. And so thankfully, I think in recent years, that kind of thought process has gone away, because I think that was what led to a lot of pastors' kids rebelling. It was absent dads. It was also this need to be performative. Like you better behave because you're the pastor's kid. my wife and I've tried really hard not to put that sort of stigma on our kids, to let our kids be their kids and, you know, to be like the other kids at church. And same with the pastor's wife or the pastor's husband. Let them just be a member of the church. I know that can be difficult in some churches, but I think that's going to set up for healthy marriages and longstanding pastor relationships within the church. So I found this. I thought this would be a fun way to end the show today. Relevant Magazine wrote 10 celebrities who grew up as pastor's kids. Some of these are big celebrities that I didn't know about. So they begin, some of these are actually celebrities. I don't know who they are. It just makes me feel a little old. But here we go. There are a lot of stereotypes about pastor's kids, some more fair than others. But maybe the safest thing you can say about being a PK is that it comes with some expectations. Every Sunday morning, you're on a stage, sometimes literally, with members of the congregation going through a mental checklist of how you do or don't fit in with their preconceived notions of what the son-daughter of a preacher ought to be like. Some PKs go on to become pastors themselves. Some get out of the church as fast as possible. And some of them go on to be extremely famous entertainers. Here are a few stars that you probably didn't know came from ministry families. Number one, John Boyega. He's a Star Wars star, and he's fairly private when it comes to his family, but he has shared that his father was a Pentecostal minister who has had some major impact, who has had a major impact on his faith and his career. He once wrote on Instagram about his parents, "The skill and ability that I've received has been from your prayers, and I cannot ignore what God has used my parents to do in my life." Number two, Hunter Schafer. The Euphoria actress revealed that both her parents are church leaders in Raleigh, North Carolina. Her father, Mac, is the lead pastor at Hudson Memorial Presbyterian Church, and her mother, Katie, is the director of children and family ministries at First Presbyterian Church as well. Euphoria. All right, Marcus Mumford. Before Marcus Mumford teamed up with his sons, he grew up as a PK, right? Mumford and Sons, the band. He grew up as a PK to John and Eleanor Mumford, who were international leaders of the Vineyard Church. In 1987, the couple established the very first British Vineyard Church in Southwest London and led the church until 2015. In a 2022 interview, Mumford shared that watching his parents lead a church shaped the way he led Mumford and Sons. He says, "I was watching my folks at the center of attention, and I think dealing with that really well. But it did provide some element of training for what I chose to later do." All right, this is one of the more famous ones. Number four, Katy Perry. You may know that Katy Perry got her start in a church choir, but she's not the only one who started their fame journey from the pulpit. Perry's parents, Keith and Mary Hudson, served as traveling preachers and speakers for a few years while their daughter was gaining notoriety. Katy Perry has very much kind of distanced herself from the church and the faith, but you'll hear her talk about, if you watch American Idol, you'll hear her talk about her upbringing as a pastor's kid. Number five, Adam Driver. The Star Wars actor was raised by his mother and stepfather, who is a Baptist pastor in Indiana. Driver grew up in the church and even credits his time in the church choir as his first step into the entertainment world. Number six, Kellis. The milkshake singer grew up with a Pentecostal minister for a father, but he was also a musician and professor who helped her develop her career. Number seven, sports world. Those of you in Chicago will know this guy very well. Former coach of the Bulls, Phil Jackson. Regarded as one of the greatest basketball coaches of all time, Phil Jackson was known off the court for his New Age philosophy. That's a stark contrast to his upbringing, where he was raised by two Assemblies of God preachers who assumed he'd one day become a minister. Number eight, the Jonas Brothers. Never knew this. Nick, Joe, and Kevin grew up as PKs in New Jersey. Their father, Kevin Sr., began his ministry as a singer with Christ for the Nations Institute in Dallas, before becoming the senior pastor of a church in Wyckoff, New Jersey. The Jonases aren't the only PK siblings who grew up to be musicians. The next one, number nine, Kings of Leon. Kings of Leon's Caleb, Nathan, and Jared Followill grew up with a father who was a United Pentecostal church preacher. The boys first developed their love of music by playing in church bands before their dad would speak from the pulpit. And the last one, I never knew this one. The most famous guy on this entire list, Denzel Washington. Denzel Washington's father served as a Pentecostal pastor in New York. Washington attended church for the first 14 years of his life before his parents divorced, and he lost touch with his dad. There are some famous people who are pastors' kids. Hey, if you're a pastor out there, raise your kids just to be kids. Don't make them be the pastor's kids. Let them just be kids. Let them make their mistakes. Let them be who they are. And church, allow that for them as well. Denzel Washington. Man, never knew that. Never knew. Knew the Katy Perry one. Never knew the Denzel Washington one. Well, we got one more day in the week. Be sure to join us tomorrow from 4 until 6. My name is Brian Fromm. Thanks for listening today. You've been listening to The Common Good. AIM 1160. Hope for your life.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.